news about John. She merely rolled her eyes and told me to stop believing in fairy tales.
En el nombre del Padre, y del Hijo, y del Espíritu Santo. Amen.
They say, and everyone in the room makes the sign of the cross in unison with this last sentence, myself included, to keep up appearances. Forehead, chest, left shoulder, right shoulder. I had been asleep, dreaming of running down a mountain with my arms out at my sides, as if I was about to take flight, when I had been awoken by the pain and glow of the third scar, wrapping itself around my lower leg. The light had woken several girls in the room, but thankfully, not the attending sister. The girls thought I had a flashlight and a magazine under the covers, and that I was breaking the rules of curfew. On the bed next to mine, Elena, a quiet 16-year-old with jet black hair she often sticks in her mouth when speaking, had thrown a pillow at me. My flesh had begun to bubble, and the pain had been so intense I had to bite on the edge of my blanket to remain quiet. I couldn't help but cry, because somewhere number three had lost his or her life. There were six of us left now. Tonight I file out of the nave with the rest of the girls and head to our sleeping quarters filled with creaky twin beds evenly spaced apart. But in my mind, I am hatching a plan. To compensate for the hard beds and the concrete chill of every room, the linens are soft and the blankets heavy, the only real luxury we're afforded. My bed is in the back corner, farthest from the door, which is the most sought-after spot. It's the quietest, and it took me a long time to get it, moving one bed closer as each girl left. The lights are shut off once everyone is settled in. I lie on my back and stare at the faint, jagged outline of the high ceiling. An occasional whisper breaks the silence, followed immediately by the attending sister shushing whoever it came from. I keep my eyes open, waiting impatiently for everyone to fall asleep. After a half hour, the whispers fade, replaced by the soft sounds of sleep. But I don't dare risk it yet. Too soon. Another 15 minutes, and still no sounds. Then, I can't stand it any longer. I hold my breath and inch my legs over the edge of the bed, listening to the rhythm of Elena's breathing beside me. My feet find the icy floor and turn cold instantly. I stand slowly to keep the bed from creaking, and then tiptoe across the room and towards the door, taking my time, being careful not to bump any beds. I reach the open doorway and rush out into the hall and down to the computer room. I pull out the chair and push the computer's power button. I fidget, waiting for the computer to boot up, and keep peering towards the hallway to see if anyone has followed. I'm finally able to type in the web address and the screen goes white. Then two pictures take shape in the center of the page, surrounded by text with a top headline in bold black letters too blurry to read. Two images now. I wonder what changed since I tried to check earlier. And then, at last, they come into focus. International terrorists? John Smith, with his square jaw, shaggy dark blonde hair, and blue eyes, fills the left side of the screen, while his father, or more likely, Saipan, Henri, takes up the right. What's there isn't a photo, but a black and white artist's sketch done in pencil. I skim the details I already know. Demolished school, five deaths, abrupt disappearance, and then come to the breaking news only now being reported. In a bizarre twist, FBI investigators today uncovered what is believed to be the tools of a professional counterfeiter. Several machines, typically used for the creation of documents, were found in the Paradise, Ohio home rented by Henri and John Smith, in a hatch beneath the floorboards of the master bedroom, leading investigators to consider possible links to terrorism. Creating local uproar within the Paradise community, Henri and John Smith are now considered a threat to national security, fugitives, and investigators are asking for any and all information that might lead to their whereabouts. I scroll back to John's image, and when my gaze meets his, my hands begin to shake. His eyes, even in this sketch, there's something familiar about them. How could I know them if not from the year-long journey that brought us here? Nobody can convince me now that he isn't one of the six remaining guard, still alive in this foreign world. I lean back and blow my bangs out of my eyes, wishing I could go in search of John myself. Of course Henri and John Smith are able to elude police. They've kept hidden for 11 years now, just as Adelina and I have. But how can I possibly hope to be the one to find him when the whole world is looking? How can any of us hope to come together? The eyes of the Mogadorians are everywhere. I have no idea how one or three were found, but I believe they located two because of a blog post he or she had written. I had found it, and then I'd sat there for 15 minutes thinking how best to respond without giving myself away. Though the message itself had been obscure, it was very obvious to those of us looking. 9. Now 8. Are the rest of you out there? It had been posted by an account called 2. My fingers found the keyboard, and I'd typed a quick response, and just before I hit the post button, the page refreshed. Somebody else had responded first. "We are here," it read. My mouth had dropped open, and I'd stared in utter shock. Hope flooded through me from those 2 brief messages, but just as my fingers had typed a different reply, a bright glow appeared at my feet, and the sizzling sound of burning flesh reached my ears, followed closely by a searing pain so great that I dropped to the floor and writhed in agony, screaming at the top of my lungs for Adelina, holding my hands over my ankles so no one else would see. When Adelina arrived and realized what was happening, I'd pointed at the screen, but it was blank. Both posts had been deleted. I look away from John Smith's familiar eyes on the screen. Beside the computer sits a small flower that's been forgotten. It's wilted and tired, shrunken down to half its normal height, a brown, crispy tinge at the edge of its leaves. Several petals have dropped, now dry and crinkled on the desk around the pot. The flower isn't dead yet, but it's not far off. I lean forward and cup my hands around it, move my face near enough so that my lips brush against the edge of its leaves, and then I blow hot air over it. An icy feeling shoots down my spine, and in response, life bursts through the small flower. It springs upward, and a verdant green floods the leaves and stalk, and new petals bloom, colorless at first, then turning a brilliant purple. A mischievous grin sprouts on my face, and I can't help but think of how the sisters would react if they were to see such a thing. But I'll never let them. It would be misinterpreted, and I don't want to be cast out into the cold. I'm not ready for that. Soon, but not just yet. I turn off the computer and hurry back to bed while thoughts of John Smith, somewhere out there, swim in my head. Be safe, and stay hidden, I think. We'll find each other yet.
Chapter 3. A low whisper finds me. The voice is cold. I can't seem to move, but I listen intently. I'm not asleep anymore. But I'm not awake either. I'm paralyzed, and as the whispers increase, my eyes are whisked away through the impenetrable darkness of my motel room. The electricity I feel as the vision breaks above my bed reminds me of when my first legacy, Lumen, lit up my palms in Paradise, Ohio. Back when Henri was still here, still alive. But Henri's gone now. He's not coming back. Even in this state, I can't escape that reality. I completely enter the vision above me, blazing through its darkness with my hands turned on. But the glow is swallowed by the shadows. And then I snap to a halt. Everything falls silent. I lift my hands in front of me, but touch nothing. My feet off the ground, floating in a great void. More whispering in a language I don't recognize, but somehow, still understand. The words burst forth anxiously. The darkness fades, and the world I'm in turns a shade of gray, on its way to a white so bright I have to squint to see. A mist drifts in front of me and filters away, revealing a large, open room with candles lining the walls.
I don't know what went wrong,
a voice says, clearly shaken. The room is long and wide, the size of a football field. The acrid smell of sulfur burns my nostrils, makes my eyes water. The air is hot and stuffy. And then I see them, at the far end of the room. Two figures, shrouded in shadows, one much bigger than the other, and menacing even from a distance.
They got away. Somehow they got away. I don't know how.
I move forward. I feel the sort of calm that sometimes comes in dreams when you're aware you're asleep, and that nothing can really hurt you. Step by step, nearing the growing shadows.
All of them killed, along with 3 Pryken and 2 Krolls,
the smaller of the two says, standing with fidgeting hands beside the larger man.
We had them. We were about to,
comes the voice, but the other cuts him off. He scans the air to see what he's already sensed. I stop, stand motionless, and hold my breath. And then he finds me. A shudder runs up my spine.
John?
Somebody says, the voice a distant echo. The larger figure comes towards me. He towers over me, 20 feet tall, muscular, a chiseled jaw. His hair isn't long like the others, but cut short instead. His skin is tan. Our eyes stay locked as he slowly approaches, 30 feet away, then 20. He stops 10 feet short. My pendant grows heavy, and the chain cuts into my neck. Around his throat, like a collar, I notice a grotesque purplish scar.
I've been expecting you,
he says, his voice level and calm. He lifts his right arm and pulls a sword from the sheath on his back. It comes alive at once, keeping its shape while the metal turns nearly liquid. The wound in my shoulder, from the soldier's dagger during the battle in Ohio, screams with pain as though I'm being stabbed all over again. I fall to my knees.
It's been a very long time, he says.
I don't know what you're talking about, I say in a language I've never spoken before. I want to leave immediately, wherever this place is. I try to rise, but it's as if I'm suddenly stuck to the ground.
Don't you?
He asks. John, I hear again from somewhere on the periphery. The Mogadorian doesn't seem to notice, and there's something about his gaze that holds my own. I can't look away. I'm not supposed to be here, I say. My voice sounds watery. Everything dims until it's just the two of us and nothing else.
I can make you disappear if that's what you want, he says,
slashing a figure eight with the sword, leaving a stark white streak hanging in the air where the blade passes through. And then he charges, his sword held high and cracking with power. He swings, and it comes down like a bullet aimed for my throat, and I know that there's nothing I can do to stop the blow from decapitating me.
John!
The voice screams again. My eyes whip open. Two hands grip me hard by the shoulders. I'm covered in sweat and out of breath. I focus first on Sam standing over me, then on Six, with her stark hazel eyes that sometimes look blue and sometimes green, kneeling beside me, appearing tired and worn as though I just woke her, which I probably did.
What was that all about?
Sam asks. I shake my head, letting the vision dissipate, and I take in my surroundings. The room is dark, with the curtains drawn, and I'm lying in the same bed I've spent the last week and a half in, healing from the battle wounds. Six has been recovering beside me, and neither she nor I have left this place since we arrived, relying on Sam to head out for food and supplies. A shabby motel room with two full beds off the main street in Trucksville, North Carolina. To rent the room, Sam had used one of the 17 driver's licenses Henri created for me before he was killed. And luckily, the old man at the front desk was too busy watching TV to study the photograph. Situated on the northwestern edge of the state, the motel is a 15-minute drive from both Virginia and Tennessee, a location chosen mainly because we had traveled as far as we could go, given the extent of our injuries. But our wounds have slowly healed, and our strength is finally returning.
You were talking in a foreign language I'd never heard before, Sam says. I think you made it up, dude.
No, he was talking in Mogadorian,
Six corrects him,
and even a little Loric.
Really? I ask. That's totally weird. Six walks to the window and pulls back the right side of the curtains.
What were you dreaming about?
I shake my head. I'm not really sure. I was dreaming, but I wasn't dreaming, you know. Having visions, I guess. And they were about them. We were about to have a battle. But I was, I don't know, too weak or confused or something. I look up at Sam, who is frowning and looking at the TV.
What? Bad news, he sighs, shaking his head.
What? I sit up, wipe the sleep from my eyes. Sam nods to the front of the room, and I turn to the glow of the television. My face takes up the entire left half of the screen, while an artist's rendering of Henri's is on the right. The drawing looks nothing like him. His face seems sharp and haggard to the point of emaciation, giving him the appearance of being 20 years older than he really is. Or was.
As if being called a threat to national security or a terrorist wasn't bad enough, Sam says. They're now offering a reward.
For me? I ask.
For you and Henri. $100,000 for any information leading to your and Henri's capture, and $250,000 if somebody brings either of you in on their own, Sam says.
I've been on the run all of my life, I say, rubbing my eyes. What difference does it make?
Yeah, well, I haven't, and they're offering a reward for me, too, Sam says. A measly $25,000, if you can believe that. And I don't know how good of a fugitive I am. I've never done this before.
I gingerly scoot up the bed, still a little stiff. Sam sits on the other bed and places his head in his palms. You're with us, though, Sam. We have your back, I say.
I'm not worried, he says into his chest.
I chew on the insides of my cheeks, thinking about how I'm going to keep him safe, and me and Six alive, without Henri. I turn to face Sam, who is